welcome to the CWF Gamecast. I'm Tom Barbalay, and today I'm joined by a fellow who's quickly becoming a co-host of the show, the one and only Neil Shook. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Pretty good.
Good, yeah. I must admit, rather than the last time that we spoke, this time I'm actually awake.
Very good.
Which always helps.
The roles are reversed here because I had an early morning start and I think I'm awake, but I'm not totally sure. So the reason that I wanted to invite you back on was with regards to the force on force rules. And some background to this. I've been pestered by Amazon for about 4 or 5 months about this rule set. They have some kind of intelligent algorithm that seems to know my particular reading interests, in particular the Osprey and kind of modern Afghan-related reading interests that I seem to have. And they had been pitching me force on force for, like I said, about 4 months. But it took a review on your very podcast, Meeples and Miniatures, before I even considered purchasing it. And almost instantly, having listened to your review, I purchased the rulebook, which at the time was at a substantial discount because it hadn't yet been released. It arrived a few weeks later, and I think I was actually chatting with you online soon after it first arrived. But I've been through the rulebook a number of times, and I have a slightly different take on it than your take. But I thought it would be an immense luxury to have the chance to kind of walk you through my particular take, because I'm sure that you have your own insights. And my understanding is that you have actually played an earlier incarnation of this rule set. Have you actually played the current incarnation of Force on Force?
I've given it a very quick go, but I must admit my experience with Force on Force is primarily from its version 1 and also playing Ambush Alley. So from what I remember from going through the rules and everything, I don't think that much has changed as far as the man-to-man fighting is concerned. I haven't played the new vehicle rules. I'll put my hands up and say now I haven't played the new vehicle rules, but I have played the man-to-man rules.
Interesting. So I'll give you my initial impressions. In fact, I have many impressions. The more that I read, the more my impressions changed. But I think some of my early criticism still sticks. So to give you some background in my particular gaming interest, well, actually my particular reading interest as well, one of the reasons that Amazon probably pitched me so heavily in this is that I have a kind of background interest in, the rise of the Mujahideen, fundamentally, going through from Algeria to Chechnya to Afghanistan, and a number of the smaller conflicts. And this interest came from, my mother was a diplomat for a number of years, and she was posted in Malaysia in the mid-90s, and I used to go up and visit her. And the local newspaper, the English newspaper, the New Straits Times, was very positive associated with the Chechen rebels. And it was the first time that I had ever really been exposed to an in-depth account of the nature of, I guess, insurgency, for want of a better term. And from that interest in my late teens and also an interest in youth movements, which I think probably explains a lot of these kind of forces, I developed an interest in the motivations and moving into also my interest in wargaming, how one actually would play these kind of forces and develop their logic. And in full disclosure, I'm also writing a skirmish rule set currently, which is loosely based on my writing Field of Chaos, but also highly applicable to modern-day Afghanistan, probably modern-day Iraq, and a variety of conflicts that I've described in terms of Chechnya and these kind of things, predominantly skirmish. Yeah. I haven't expanded the rules to anything larger than very small force interactions. But I do have an interest in this kind of stuff. And the thing that struck me initially when I received the force-on-force rules was it was a bit like receiving... I tried to think of a series of metaphors associated with this, but it would be a bit like receiving, I guess... Well, Saving Private Ryan is a good example, and to a lesser extent, the Band of Brothers series, in terms of their account of the Second World War. And I guess my sense receiving the force-on-force rules is... I guess my initial view was that force-on-force appeared to describe almost American forces on American forces, because the level of detail associated, particularly with US forces, was vastly disproportionate to any kind of insurgency forces or VC or these kind of things. And as I read through the rules initially, I felt very critical associated with that. And I was trying to really explore the rules and get an understanding of how one would actually play. Well, it's interesting because the movement from irregular to regular forces in opposing forces, particularly in Afghanistan, but also, I understand, probably in Iraq and other conflicts, is very curious. And that was something that only really dawned on me having read through it once. The idea that actually what you would typically think of as being irregular forces, particularly with regards to jihadists and these kind of things, were actually, and I think this is quite legitimate, considered regular forces. But I don't know, it was a strange rule set for me, because I thought this is, and obviously I live in the US, but I probably have a slightly different perspective on US-style conflicts from the background reading that I've described. But yeah. I just found it a very asymmetric perspective in my initial reading. And I think in particular there were sections towards the end that dealt with actually playing insurgents, what they describe as insurgents. And they describe, and I'll quote here, "Playing the insurgents against well-trained and well-equipped regulars can be an intimidating prospect. You're often outgunned and your troops are often of a lesser quality. These are good reasons to follow the tactics mentioned above and the tactics that are described above. Apply some of the traits which make your insurgent forces different." And I think what I found reading through the rule set, and I'm interested, I haven't bought the Iraq rules. I'm interested in the Afghan and Vietnam rules in particular. Yeah. But I'm interested in the expansion of the kind of counterforce rule set, because certainly my reading of the rules, and I got slightly more sympathetic in multiple reads, particularly this notion that maybe what I would consider insurgent forces are actually substantially regular forces. But even so, the kind of battle tactics that are used, and this is historically the case, particularly coming from Chechnya and what that moved to in Afghanistan, they are very different. I mean, they're very different perspectives with regards to battle and force organization and all these kind of things. And I guess I'm limited because I only have the current force on force rule set to get a better understanding. My hope is, particularly in the Afghan rules, that this is expanded on substantially. But I guess that's my initial criticism. I have a number of kind of smaller parts associated with that. But when you played the previous incarnation of this rule set, what kind of periods and battles were you undertaking, and what's your kind of feedback associated with this initial criticism?
I originally played Ambush Alley, which is, the, for want of a better phrase, the first pass through of the rules, it was the original rule set that was published, and that was simply looking at the asymmetric combat with small units of regular forces versus larger units of insurgents, as they term it. It potentially takes a slightly simplistic view of the way, for want of a better phrase, non-free world forces work. It's almost like there is a basic assumption that asymmetric forces in some ways work similarly if you put them through the Vietnam conflict as if you put them through Iraq, Afghanistan, or what have you. Now, obviously, I mean, once you go into, I mean, they've got a new publication coming out called Ambush Alley, which again will be a second version of Ambush Alley, because they did publish Ambush Alley for the original Force on Force rules. There's a lot deeper clarification of asymmetric forces, and particularly the way that VC and NVA worked within that system. But I can certainly take your point that it's a very free world bias as far as the view of what you're doing. I think almost to a certain extent, when Ambush Alley came out, I think it was a case of you could almost play the insurgents as an automatic force to play against. So yes. Effectively, you could virtually just run the game. So you would be playing the US forces against a game-controlled insurgency force.
I think that was your initial review, and I certainly remember your description associated with that. Mm. I think in Vietnam in particular, and this again is relatively biased, but in Vietnam and building on ideas, well, for example, like Space Hulk, this notion of kind of continuous hidden forces that are coming at you. I think that would work, but in terms of the... I mean, the question that I had going through the book is, why would you ever want to play the Insurgents if you were having this kind of battle? And this is interesting. I haven't seen the Vietnam Rules for Flames of War, but that is something that interests me as well in a similar light in terms of how the Viet Cong are actually portrayed. And I guess my view reading through these rules is that the bias was so strong in the initial reading that I almost felt a sense of guilt. And when I read it the second time, I went back with the reading of the view that probably I have, well, in terms of just background reading, in terms of instructional literature, and a lot of the stuff that I'm getting now comes from the US military directly, because there is stuff that they're writing associated with now very long-term, you know, combat experience associated with, in particular, well, that they divide the forces very neatly in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan. They're quite distinct fighting styles. But I think the thing that struck me in the second read was, could I play this rule set with an alter of perhaps, well, my interest isn't one of the many factions that exist in Afghanistan, probably a Haqqani force, actually, because I think they have a very interesting set of allegiances versus perhaps a Taliban or, I don't know, a generic insurgent force. But anyway, could I use my background knowledge in terms of fighting styles and these kind of things in order to kind of make the rules seem a little bit more even? And yeah. I guess that's why I'm waiting for the Afghanistan rules in particular to actually see if that plays through. But my general readings continued the more times that I reread, in particular the, I don't know, almost kind of laissez-faire attitude with regards to any description of opposing forces. And I think certainly my background reading of Osprey, the counterexample to this actually is their Algerian coverage. Their coverage of the Algerian conflict, I think, is relatively neutral. But aside from that, they have a real difficulty creating a kind of neutral historical approach when dealing with these kind of conflicts. I mean, they don't even cover Chechnya, and have written in their forums about why they decided not to cover Chechnya. And I don't know, it was a... Obviously, because I'm writing my own rule set, I'm very sensitive to how actually you kind of reverse rules in these circumstances and look for considerations, not necessarily even of fairness, but to acknowledge the strengths that you're dealing with, I guess, from our perspective, a foe that has been very resilient for, you know, 30-plus years fighting multiple conflicts, and clearly they have structures that enable them to continue to repel... well, the US military and other militaries. And I think what I was looking for in the force-on-force rules was a greater degree of analysis in terms of how one actually constructs this in a wargaming context. And I guess my real hope was, particularly because this rule set has been, well, made so professionally in terms of its ability and to get access to a wide variety of folk that may not even consider this kind of gaming. I'm waiting for them, for the rules to actually appear in the local borders and these kind of places, because I think there's a good fit in terms of just the aesthetic of the rules.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I get the sense certainly that Henry Hyde listens to this particular recording. And my view in a broader sense is, if there were better rule sets associated with this kind of contemporary conflict, then there would be a greater degree of understanding associated with, and I don't necessarily want to get too political, but how basically the conflict has perpetuated. And I think, unfortunately, I just didn't find that in the force-on-force rule set, although, like I said, I'm interested in the Afghan expansion in particular. In terms of this, do you get a sense that there are other rule sets out there that are probably better suited to this asymmetric conflict problem, or
right, as you probably gather from my review, I don't get that same level of disquiet about these rules that you have, although I will freely admit that I am not as well read on the subject as you are. So, I mean, obviously, I've been, you know, listening through to some of the back catalogue of CDRF podcasts, when, yeah, and you, obviously you've been looking especially at Chechnya, etc., for quite some time. And
well,
it's
about 12, 13, well, actually, far too many years to count, actually. 17 years now, I'm embarrassed. since the first Chechen War. So, yeah, I've been following the conflict a long period of time.
Right. Okay, so, first of all, I cannot hope to come anywhere near your level of understanding of this sort of thing. I came from it, I must admit, from a much shallower angle, shall we say, looking at it primarily as a gamer as opposed to a potentially actually this is a subject we're going to end up covering in a future View from the Veranda. What's the difference between a gamer and a war gamer? And sometimes it does boil down to how interpretation of history and whether or not you're looking at a rule set to play a game, or whether you're looking at a rule set that accurately accurately reflects exactly what went on in a particular conflict.
I understand. I would certainly
understand the criticism that force on force does tend to simplify that particular aspect. So also, although it has various period settings, and to be honest, looking through example the first scenario book for Iraq, it does seem to make a very good attempt at trying to accurately reflect what went on in particular scenarios, what went on during particular events. For example, looking at something completely different, their Day of the Ranger expansion, for example, looking at Mogadishu, which is something that I am, which is much more of an interest that's what one of the reasons why I originally picked Ambush Alley up, was because of that and the Day of the Ranger expansion. And that expansion is very, very good. I think they are potentially guilty of having a broad brush approach to things, as opposed to they are guilty of using a broad brush as opposed to going down into detail. And so from that, obviously, a lot of the nuances of different forces and stuff tend to get mixed. And again, because, as you rightly say, it's very much a free world force point of view. So it's very much it isn't really even a UK point of view. It's very much from an American point of view, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Now, as far as other rule sets that may deal with this better. Right, from looking at modern conflicts, one thing that's to look at is the flying lead rules. Now, these are produced by Ganesha Games and written by a guy called Rich Jones, who I've had on the show a couple of times. But in particular, he wrote a campaign book for that particular rule set, based for Afghanistan. And that was based on experiences through both reading, obviously looking through newsreel documentary footage, and what have you, and also speaking to some UK vets.
Cool.
And getting their experiences on what went on. That may have a slightly different take on the conflict as opposed to what Force on Force deals with. So that is something else that I think is definitely worth a look. Probably more. It's divergent from Afghanistan and Chechnya and that sort of thing. But going back to Vietnam, and a different level because it's company level as opposed to skirmish level. But Charlie Don't Surf.
I'd already written it out, Neil.
I was going to say, the Charlie Don't Surf rules from Two Fat Lardies.
Yes.
Now, as I say, first and foremost, they deal with Vietnam from a company level as opposed to a skirmish platoon sized game or smaller.
Certainly.
Which again, so the tactics change slightly anyway because again, Force on Force is a at best platoon level game. I mean, I know people have played company level with it, with up to multiple platoons, but pretty much Force on Force is aimed at platoon level with multiple fire teams and not potentially multiple companies. Something like Charlie Don't Surf, for example, is aimed at company level, and again, the way that game works as far as modelling the asymmetry of the combat with especially the way it governs all the scenarios work. So effectively, the two sides are working to completely different objectives whenever you play a scenario. And so the way that balancing of the game works in that particular sense is the fact that, despite the fact you have the huge difference in technology when it comes down to US forces versus VC and VA forces, because of the way the scenarios are set up and the way the game works from that side of things, it has both a military and, for want of a better word, a political objective to each game that you play. So you could, so the US player could easily win a particular game from a military point of view, but it also takes into account thing. It also starts taking into account things like collateral damage, acceptable losses, and that sort of thing. And so the way those mechanics work is that, although again, from a game point of view, you start getting to when you're dealing with these sort of conflicts, when you turn around and say, okay, it's probably more fun to play the US. Fun being a, let's face it, it's a game. So it is. So I'm dealing with the word fun from, or say enjoyable maybe to play from a US point of view. There are certainly it's certainly not straightforward, and Richard Clarke has put a lot of work into making sure that any game that you play, it's equally easy for the VC and VA player to achieve their objectives in scenarios, because, as I say, their objectives can be completely different, and an awful lot of it revolves around It's not just about body count, shall we say,
certainly,
at the end of the day. And to be honest, in these sorts of games, that's what it's going to come down to. And this is where these games are divergent from setup and points-based games where you're simply dealing with victory points.
Certainly.
You've got to deal with all of these games from a scenario point of view, and deal with them that the scenarios have got to be in place so that doesn't matter if you're playing Free World or Insurgent Forces or VC or what have you. If the scenario is well written so that your victory conditions are achievable on both sides, then that's what makes the game, as opposed to simply making the games about body count. Because if you simply start making the games about body count, then from that side of things, the theory is that Free World, UK, UN forces will potentially win every time. But and I know that modern conflicts isn't just about body count. It's about it's about different things. And this is what they're attempting to, and this is what these style of games are attempting to do, which is something a bit different from earlier approaches. The vast majority of World War II style forward games at the moment tend to deal with a lot of straight up battles, or you know, you've got attacker defender style battles. But essentially, your objective is all about either getting to a certain getting to a certain point in the table by a certain time, by a certain turn number in the game, or inflicting a certain number of casualties on your opponent. And both Charlie Don't Surf, Force on Force, and Flying Lead, especially in the Afghan expansion, which I shall have to look up and let you know what it is.
Very good.
But those rule sets all try and do something a little bit different, because they're all very much more scenario driven, if that makes sense.
It certainly does. It certainly does. And thank you. Thank you for that those series of points, Neil, actually. I was taking furious notes as you were talking, and I think I would have to agree with you on a number of those points. In particular, my only experience with regards to Force on Force comes with the solid hardcover rulebook. And certainly in my reading, what you described as it with the broad brush and the greater degree of detail, I sympathetically felt as I read through, particularly on future reads. It's a very, I don't want to start the discussion associated with the distinction between a gamer and a wargamer, but it is a very interesting distinction, and I'm certainly interested in hearing your and Henry's particular perspective.
I'm going to be talking about that, funnily enough, actually, with Rich Clark as well, because there's been a lot of very interesting discussions going on this particular sort of subject, on things like the miniatures page, and that's kicked off discussions on other discussion groups, all around about this sort of distinction, what makes a gamer as opposed to a war gamer, and why do we get so het up about something as war gamers, when gamers kind of say, well, just get on and play the game. I think it does actually boil down to where your particular interests lie, and whereas some people will play a particular conflict, and because they enjoy playing war games, they will enjoy getting on with the game and playing the game and taking the game on face value. If you then end up playing in a particular conflict that you know an awful lot more about, then it stands to reason that you're going to be a lot more picky about what's going on. You're going to be you are going to be a lot more critical, simply because obviously you're coming from your own experience.
I guess it boils down to the idea of what fun is, and this is the interesting description. I guess the idea of fun and this is a continuum, as you've described. This isn't really two distinct groups, because obviously as people become more passionately interested, they're going to, that fun is going to be with regards to some kind of exploration of their own knowledge as well. I would agree with you, and in fact it's been a wonderful opportunity to actually have this discussion with you, Neil, because I think what you've described is that there are different rules for different folks. And to summarise, I mean, if that is accurate.
Yeah, I think you're entirely right. I mean, that other rule book I was talking about for Afghanistan for Flying Lead, it's actually called Hearts and Minds.
Okay.
And the one interesting thing in that particular campaign set, again, is that you've got it's a series of scenarios, and you can put together a set of campaign. Well, it's got a set of campaign rules for it, but again, it's not just about body count. It's about affecting it's been a while since I've read it, so. I'm being very broad brush and kind of high level on this, because I'll need to go back and read it just to get the exact details. But the book is very much operating on two different levels, and it all boils down to scenario objectives. So that's what Hearts and Minds is all about. But this goes back to what you're saying. as far as whatever rule set you play, and funnily enough, this harks back to whatever period. For example, I've just played New Hail Caesar rules, okay, ancient rule set, last week, and thoroughly enjoyed it. But that's going through a lot of criticism currently on several online forums, simply because that particular rule set has not been published with a set of army lists with number of points per different. So the people who are used to playing Warmaster Ancients or are used to playing WAB or what have you, have come to this different rule set written by Rick Priestley, and they're kind of going, well, hang on a second, where's the army lists? Whereas that particular rule set, what it's doing is saying, okay, it's scenario driven. So it's take a look at, take a look at a particular battle. How were the forces laid out? Sort that into, you've got to do a lot of work up front to sort out a particular scenario. And then these set of rules will then let you help, play the battle. As opposed to, okay, 2,000 points aside, okay, let's go. And so what you end up in a... What we are, I think, finding more and more is that we have different sets of rules which are aimed at different types of gamers. Going back to Flames of War. I mean, as you may well know from listening to Meeples and Miniatures, Flames of War is actually one of my pet hates when it comes to World War II rules. You may wonder why, but ultimately the reason why is simply because, from my perspective and from what I've played of Flames of War, it's the sort of game that promotes power gaming, cheesy armies.
Yeah.
And, why is it that whenever you, if you look at what across all Flames of War, all Flames of War gamers, there will be at least 50 or 60% of them that run SS Panzer companies with with lots of heavy tank battalions and Panthers and various other bits and pieces. And then you look back and kind of go, well, hang on a second. So show me that, show me where that formation exists.
Certainly.
Now some people, and again, this very much depends on the gamer. Some people will go, well, okay, I'm building my force based on, Panzerlehr in Normandy 1944, and they will go away and do that. And I must admit, I'll put my hand up at this point and say that that's the sort of gamer I am. Whereas other people will go and say, what force gives me the best bang for my points, and what is the best army for what force gives me the best army for playing this game?
Certainly.
And I think that's where you get the division.
So, I mean, I think we can probably agree that Flames of War is a World War II themed game. It's and I think this is the thing that's interesting. I mean, I certainly feel this about, more so the Warhammer Fantasy rule set, but I just see kind of generations of kids getting interested in this kind of stuff, and irrespective of what I feel about the contemporary ranges that Citadel is producing, the prices, all the above, at least it's getting kids reading, exploring fantasy universes, and pursuing the kind of things that you and I did in our degenerate youth. And my feeling with regards to Flames of War is similar. That you're right. The power, and I need to speak carefully here because we have a group of folk that have come over from the What Would Patton Do podcast, which is predominantly the kind of Flames of War players that you're commenting about slightly disparagingly. But aside from that, and I'm sure they're still listening. I'm sure their emails are queued. But anyway, aside from that, I think what we're describing here is different strokes for different folks, fundamentally, that all these kind of components, and basically what we have currently is really a smorgasbord of gaming. I mean, I think we are... in terms of just looking at the general progress of all these kinds of rule sets, we are now completely spoiled for choice no matter what direction we look for, and we are ultimately the defining factors in terms of picking out rules that we particularly like and following them accordingly. I think this is a very strong point. The thing that I really liked about the Force-on-Force rules is it got me onto a wide variety of miniature manufacturers' websites, looking at a variety of scales and also manufacturers that I hadn't looked at previously. I mean, my moderns are very much 28mm, and I've been thoroughly frustrated with the scale in terms of actually, fighting these kind of conflicts. And looking at 10, 15, and 20mm more seriously, Force-on-Force motivated this, I don't know what we call exploration, basically. And I thought that was very good. And the floating scale also, I thought, was very good in terms of actually thinking about what one wanted to game. Now, where one kind of continues on with this particular rule set, I've already raised some concerns. But I thought there were some strengths through the rules associated with, as you say, this kind of floating scale, potentially floating points, and also, as you've described more strongly with Rich Jones's rules, which I'm going to have to purchase a copy and thumb through thoroughly, he appears to have tackled this in a much more direct fashion. But I guess, in conclusion, we've basically come to an agreement that there are different rule sets out there for different folks, and really it's our responsibility to find them rather than picking apart various rule sets. Although that's fun,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the potential disparaging remarks on against Flames of War paper, Flames of War players, that's not meant as disparaging. I mean, although I have to say, you know, that comes from my experience of playing the game, and you know, it has to be said that one of the guys who's a big Flames of War exponent in our club also happens to be a DBM composition gamer, and if you thought Flames of War, Warhammer 40K, people but potentially beardy, you haven't seen DBM players. Cool. You know? And I've probably completely alienated a whole other section of listenership with that. But
no, it's expressed by Neil Shook or of Neil Shook's alone and not of the CWF Gamecast. Okay.
Indeed. Yes, I take full responsibility for that. No, seriously. I mean, people get enjoyment out of different areas of gaming and different flavors of gaming. You know, I put my hands up and say, I'm sorry, I'm not a tournament gamer, I'm not a competition gamer, and so the whole aspect of toying with your army lists and getting the best out of a particular army for a tournament game is something that just doesn't interest me, which also happens to be probably why I'm not very good at it. And as I've talked before, you know, this is the reason why I ended up with a Deathwing army in 40K, which I was roundly criticised for wherever I went. Like, what on earth are you gaming that army for? Because I like Deathwing. Oh, okay. And I was looked in, again, it's one of those things of like, okay, yeah, it may be one of the naffest Space Marine armies you can come across, but I just like the army. There you go. But yeah, there is definitely this this difference in gaming styles and how people want to play their games. To be honest, and I've said this on several different podcasts, so you know people can go back and check if they wish. But as far as I'm concerned, although I have my pet hates, probably like anybody else in the hobby, and I'm freely, you know, I freely admit that people don't like, you know, people will not like the sort of games that I'm into. But it's, you know, it's whatever gets you interested in gaming. And to be honest, first and foremost, if you're playing games, if you're into miniatures and playing games and getting face to face with people and interacting socially, that's what the gaming hobby is all about. You know, as far as you know, if you enjoy what you're doing, whether it's intense competition gaming in Flames of War or Warhammer or what have you, or whether it's gaming scenarios and doing research to gain particular historical battles, that to me is almost second fiddle to the experience of interacting with another person and gaming, or several other people and gaming. You know, gaming for, primarily is a social hobby for me. And so if you're up and you're gaming with other people and using that as part of your social interaction, because obviously, you know, it's a common denominator. And this is why, you know, we get so much humor from, you know, talking about lead mountains and all this thing about searching through the internet for, you know, something else to buy and not paint and all this sort of thing. You know, it's because it's a common experience and we're all there. And because we have, and because we share this common experience, it means that from a social point of view, we all, you know, we all have a social, you know, we all have a social standing where we interact with each other, and then that carries on through the games that we play. And so, you know, I know, you know, my views are going to be as controversial, you know, are going to be fairly unpalatable to some people. Unfortunately, you know, that's just the way gaming is. And again, you know, whatever rule set you end up playing, there are going to be people out there that staunchly defend it. And there are going to be other people out there that want to turn around and go, you know, pick it apart and say, well, okay, this is wrong for this number of reasons. And, you know, both points of view are equally valid. I mean, you know, some people turn around and say, well, yeah, both points of view might be equally valid, but that doesn't make, you know, that doesn't make me right and you wrong. But, you know, this is gaming. And as long as, you know, people don't take themselves, you know, from my point of view, it's like, you know, don't take yourselves too seriously. At the end of the day, we're all about pushing toy soldiers around the table and collecting and painting toy soldiers. And you know, ultimately, we're all geeks to a certain extent, it's all geeks together, and we can argue left, right, and centre about the pros and cons of various rule sets and how we like, you know, and whether we like a certain set of mechanics or not. And I think sometimes as well, you know, the rule sets we gravitate to tend to be as much about, well, you know, how we like to play our games, even down to how we like to roll our dice. And, you know, and I will put my hand on that. I mean, you know, one of the big things that attracted me to Force on Force is that I love the mechanics. Why? Because half of the mechanics are taken out of Stargun. And Stargun was a game that I grew up playing with sci-fi after I stopped playing 40K. I moved on to Stargun, and I loved those mechanics, and you know, they've taken several leaves out of the old Stargun mechanics and put new twists on them, and that's one reason why I like the rules. And you know, I will be the first to put my hand up and say, well, actually, once you start like working out things like probabilities and the differences between rolling a D6 with a modifier as opposed to rolling a D8. You know, statistics-wise, it does actually get to the point where you're thinking, well, hang on a second, what's the difference? And, you know, the differences are very, very slight at the end of the day. Excuse me. But it's just down to whatever floats your boat in playing the game, as far as I can see. And yeah, I mean, some people enjoy bucket loads of dice games. Some people enjoy rolling the fewer dice, the better. Some people don't like games because you don't get to roll any dice at all. if I turn around, some people may know that I'm a huge Excellis fan. That might, in some quarters, that will completely destroy my gamer cred.
I come from a simulation background here, Neil, so I've been concerned that if I delve into Exilis, it'll all be downhill and I'll start writing my own open source rules and get sued and various other things. So, yeah, because I have developed simulations that are very similar in terms of having figures down and using computer simulations in order to actually determine the results, that's a thing that I've... tried to avoid intentionally. If I could just turn the topic slightly here, Neil, because I think we've finished the force on force discussion. In terms of Salute, in terms of this size of show,
right?
What are your basic, with the view that we are all hopeless addicts and we are really going into a crack den at a place like Salute? What are your survival rules associated with going to that kind of show and still being a married man, having concluded that show, not having spent absolutely every penny that you have? And in terms of, is Salute a multi-day show or is it only a single-day show?
Well, Salute's a single-day show. It primarily has to be simply because the cost involved with making it multi-day would mean that it just couldn't be done. Simply down to things like venue hire, and obviously the security that would be involved in maintaining the site and what have you.
So returning to my survival question, what are your golden rules?
As you may get, I'm trying to sidestep the question here because, if you have any, please let me know. Other than the fact that, I think you're going to approach these from two different directions. One thing some people tend to do, Salute especially in the UK, is your ideal one-stop shop. Because it has so many traders doing so many different things, what a lot of people actually tend to do is decide, right, okay, Salute is going to be my purchasing day for my year. And, they will spend well in excess of three figures and more on one particular day, and that will be it. There are those of us that end up perusing through the entire year. That the only way that you're ever going to be going to survive a show like Salute is either leave the plastic at home, and take out what you budgeted, stick it in your wallet, and when you spent it, it's gone.
Yeah.
Although, obviously, wherever you go, there's always going to be the thing of all of a sudden you'll come across the immiscible bargain. the new set of rules which you have just played and really enjoyed. And, look, they're launched today and they're here on offer. Mm. Or the latest must-have box of Periplastics, which are released today, which, of course, if you listen to the latest View from Veranda, leads you down to the fact that, several years later, your 10 boxes of Peri ACW figures will just be sold on to somebody else for them to paint.
And congratulations to Henry, as I know he listens in, on that very valiant effort.
Indeed. I was most impressed, it has to be said.
Yes.
I think it's like any show. Obviously, there's certainly the case of, I always do my homework before I go to shows. These days, it's a question of having to look at who's going. Hopefully you should see that before I put, especially a big show, they should be detailing, okay, what's coming out, what will we have at Salute in this, TMP for 3 or 4 weeks, and all of the news groups 3 or 4 weeks before Salute was going, okay, this is coming out at Salute and that's coming out at Salute, and especially if you weren't in the UK, you were probably sick of the sight of Salute.
Yeah. Adepticon gets its revenge as well, I guess.
Oh, yeah, Adepticon, Gen Con, or what have you, Gen Con, that's an event to avoid as far as I'm concerned. I'd love to go, but, oh, good grief, oh, no.
Well, you'd have the benefit of having a fixed, unless I guess you bought luggage here, that would probably be your downfall, actually.
Yeah, and it has to be said, it was quite funny at Salute. I overheard at least two conversations with people kind of going, yes, I really like it, but no, I can't buy it because I've just exceeded my luggage limit. And yes, I definitely heard a couple of guys, especially from the continent,
yes,
who were having that conversation with people. And that was that was quite funny. But I mean, I'm not quite sure whether I have the secret to surviving it. Simply, I mean, I'd say this year I simply kind of decided that okay, I was only going to buy one rule set, and this year I actually kept to it. But I mean, the reason I did that was because I pre-ordered the rule set.
And that was another point that I was going to make, because, I mean, your discussion recently associated with magazines, I host a show called Model Rail Radio, and the Model Rail fraternity suffers exactly the same problem, although generally there tend to be more Model Rail shows, perhaps to do with the number of folk in the hobby. But this notion of pre-ordering, but also really heavily planning where you're going to go. So the notion that you get a map, you work out which sellers you're going to go to first, because obviously they're, and then as you did, or as you appear to have done, then treat the experience as a social one more than anything. So to get the purchases out of the way early on and maybe wait till the very end for certain things, but at least have a strategy before you get there. And I really like the idea of pre-ordering as well.
Well, I had the added advantage that I was obviously putting on the game at the show. So I actually bought everything that I actually got hold of everything that I wanted, whether it was stuff that I pre-arranged to pick up, a couple of review copies of rules, a couple of purchases. I'd done all that before the show actually opened. And which actually meant that obviously I was most of my day was taken up running games, which actually means that you're tied to one place so you can't go browsing around. And then which is obviously a good thing. And then the time that I was wandering around the show was actually spent looking to talk to people.
A question then, Neil. How do you deal with being a celebrity and running a game in terms of as your listeners know where you are? Do you have to? I mean, I had this experience when I lived in the UK going to a games day one year. And I knew who I wanted to meet at the games day, but they were all running games. And I took the view very clearly, particularly because many of them were kind of crowded with lots of people actually playing the games, that I would wait until the very end and then strategically walk around or at least get a sense of the ebbs and flows of the games being played. In terms of the folk that approached you, did you have a kind of more... the game, as you describe it, appears to be relatively relaxed that you were were demoing. So it probably lends itself more to folks actually coming up to you and shaking your hand and saying things in that kind of format.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, zombie racing, it definitely isn't a serious game. And I'm sure from what I've heard, it's a game that that Jonathan would have appreciated.
Very good.
Had he been there. But... well, I'm probably not as much as a celebrity as what you may think. Although I don't know, maybe I'm just disparaging my own listenership. But it was, I mean, I certainly had a couple of things, and the worst case was actually the fact that, I mean, I was discussing this with him the other day. There's a guy who I met in an online game in 2000. And we've since become really good friends, although we've only actually met three times. But we exchange emails virtually every day. We're both gamers, and he was actually door captain at Salute, because he was the guy who's been posting an awful lot of the news and updating the blog for Salute and stuff. A guy called Colin Haygreen. We know each other really well, except for the fact that we've hardly ever met. And we did actually have that situation that we met twice on the day. The first time, Colin was right in the middle of some of his organisation for the day, so we couldn't talk. The next time, he popped over to me, and I was in the middle of running a game, and so I couldn't talk. Now, despite the fact that, you know, the game that we were running took, 20 minutes? Unfortunately, you know, we just didn't fit in with that window. What I try and do from just a gaming point of view is okay. We try and do like a one-off sort of thing. Try to keep things quite relaxed, so you do get a bit of time to take a step back and talk to people. I must admit, although I like running the game, I prefer working, for want of a better phrase, working the crowd, if you know what I mean. Sure. So when you know, going back to this discussion that myself and Henry have had before about, you know, when people are on the fringes of the game, looking at what's going on, and they haven't got anybody to talk to about, well, hang on, you know, what's this game all about? What I always try and do is make sure that there's at least a couple of us who are kind of around the crowd answering questions. That's actually what I enjoy more, is the simple fact of, of chatting with people, interaction, and of course that means that people can come up and say hi. But having said that, not that many people actually did come up. I mean, I had a few, but not as many as previous years. So, you know, my fame has obviously dropped off. But no, it's, as I say, you know, running a 20-minute game, it's fairly easy to fit it in. But unfortunately, yeah, I did have a couple of occasions where, you know, specifically wanted to chat to somebody and just couldn't catch them. And unfortunately, it's one of those things we had to put down. So, okay, you know, we'll meet to begin in 6 months' time and go from there. But as far as just the general day is concerned, I mean, it's things like looking through the coverage that people like Beasts of War did for Salute, and yeah, the interviews with people and this, that, and the other. I thought at one point I kind of do that for the Meeples and Miniatures podcast, for example. But there's this, I always think there's this tension with the fact of doing something like that, but coupled with the fact that actually these people are there supporting their livelihood for the day.
Yes,
so yeah, so actually they're, you know, they're there to sell stuff, and talking to me means that they're not talking to customers.
Yes.
So I mean, although
the point is that talking to you could mean that they were actually talking to more customers on some level as well, in terms of folks that can't make the show, international customers, these kind of things too.
Yeah, I certainly take your point, and maybe it's just me. Yeah, maybe that's something that I just need to get over and turn around and say, okay, well, actually, I'm just as valid a media as people talking to, you know, talking to War Games Illustrated or what have you. And that's a personal thing. I think that's just something that, and funnily enough, although it may not seem it, especially with the fact that, you know, we're here talking here, but going up to somebody cold and saying, oh, hi, I'm Neil from Meeples and Miniatures, do you fancy talking about this, is something I find incredibly difficult to do. And so from that side of things, I'm probably the worst person to be, you know, I'm probably the worst person to be doing it, because I find it really difficult. although, you know, it's a bizarre dichotomy, since here I am, you know, and of my own volition, I'm presenting an internet radio show which goes out across the globe and has a couple of thousand listeners and what have you, and yet, you know, I have problems going up to people who I know are, you know, have a similar interest to myself and talking to them, and it's, yeah, I think it's, I think I'll put my hand up and go, yeah, I'm just strange.
Returning to Beasts of War for a minute here, and this was one topic that I didn't actually think we'd cover, but I think there's an interesting format and style element, and certainly I've had a kind of interesting relationship with Beasts of War in terms of communication and discussion with the fellow who heads it up. His name has escaped me. But I think their direction has changed quite dramatically, and probably in the past 3 or 4 months, from being a show that I thought could potentially... I mean, you originally stopped incoming based on Beasts of War, didn't you?
Well, that was part of it. I think, incoming ended up stopping for several different reasons. The number one problem with incoming was the fact of just the sheer time it took end up producing it got out of proportion with the amount of free time I had, and plus the fact it certainly seemed that things like, for example, although I have no proof to the contrary, Reaper TV suddenly started featuring, suddenly started coming out after I've been doing incoming and featuring some of Reaper's releases. Mm. And then all of a sudden Reaper TV turns up. And it's like, oh, right, okay, so they're starting to promote their own miniatures.
Yes.
And then Beasts of War was doing their weekly show. And although, you know, we were potentially pandering to different audiences, and, you know, I'd done incoming because of the show that went on before, which has gone out of my head. Oh, crikey.
Yeah, I'm thinking of it too, and I can't think of the name. We're a right pair, Neil. But, yeah, I think our listeners
I got to the point where I think, okay, I'm struggling to produce this, but also other people are now in that market and doing it a darn sight better than me. I mean, for, you know, whether you like or dislike what Beasts of War do, you can't question the fact that their videos look really good and they do a fantastic job in producing.
I think they did initially. I mean, certainly my correspondence initially with the, and again, my mind has gone blank, but the fellow who heads it up was really his underlying intention, and also his commercial backers, because I thought that there was, particularly when I got involved, I was on the beta team for their site, and I think picked up very heavily due to, podcasting and various other kind of community growth interests. And what struck me initially was that there was stuff going on behind the scenes. I like the young guy, I think he was 23, John, who did a lot of the early assembly, and he was also a reenactor. And he's no longer associated with them. And really, most of the videos that I liked were his relatively youthful, but also willing to admit when he was, you know, when he made mistakes and this kind of thing, but a relatively detailed analysis. And I think they lost some of that. And also, the long intros and outros, and basically when you look at it in a, you know, 5-minute video, you're getting 2 minutes worth of content and these kind of things. I think they've changed direction recently, and I think as soon as they launched the site, basically, their focus changed. But what interests me is independence, and I think this is really critical. I mean, certainly doing Model Rail Radio, I've now had the privilege of knocking back sponsors because I really think that there needs to be, in these kind of hobbies, real independence in terms of ability. And I would congratulate you thoroughly for your first incoming 2.0, where you called bad products for what you thought they were. I thought that was, if you've received some criticism for that, please negate some of that with my view that this is also what the hobby needs. And really, it shows a degree of independent forethought, although I'm probably going to buy the Warhammer Historical World War II rules just because I have a collection thereof and I have an interest in the period. But truth be told, I think that kind of independence is really critical. And the thing that I liked about the original incoming was that, a large portion of it was rebroadcasting from, the miniatures page and various other pages that you'd found them on. But I don't have the time to do that. And your incoming shows were very much a sense of, there are certain things that I like that you like, some things that you like that I dislike, but at least that I would get a form that was someone who I thought had a sufficient breadth of knowledge in the kind of broader hobby, and also presented some amazingly beautiful miniatures that I never would have found through independent search. And I really like that. And in fact, the audio version of Incoming, we've recorded a show that hasn't yet come out, that describes in great detail that the audio version of Incoming is in fact far more dangerous because I sometimes accidentally listen to it at work, which is terrible with an iPhone because I'm constantly trying to find these websites and then pretend to kind of, you know, work, and I have to allocate when I actually listen to it now. I previously used to listen to the video or watch the video Incoming on a Sunday evening, and that would be kind of a ritual because I knew that I would need to have quality time in order to peruse the sites and kind of pause and rewind in the video version of Incoming. The audio version is even more troubling in that light because it's in a format that will normally fall in my lap at work. But I have to congratulate you, and I think really this kind of independence is really critical. And certainly, I think if you see things that just seem completely outside your general perspective and seem, you know, out of whack, I mean, continue to call it, Neil, because I think that's part of being independent.
Yeah, I mean, there is obviously this tension between the fact that, you know, and especially as you're getting, I'm getting more well known now, I'm starting to, you end up with situations where, you know, people are submitting stuff to you to review and what have you. And, you know, you do have to kind of firstly protect the fact that, you know, excuse me, but I know you're giving me a review copy, but please be aware that that doesn't automatically guarantee that I'm going to give it a good review. And I do not like being negative about stuff. And so actually, on the whole, unless I feel particularly strongly about something, I will not normally pick something out as being negative, because I'm a fairly positive sort of guy, and I like to pick on the, I like to concentrate on the good things or the bad things, rather than the bad things. But yeah, I mean, independence is such a key thing, especially, you know, in a hobby that has so much around that there is, you know, doesn't matter what period you do, what scale you do, the competition is huge. And when you know, if you've got a situation where you've got people that are perceived to be independent, whether you know their tastes correspond to yours or not, at least it's a case of, you know, you're getting an independent view. And I think, for example, this is potentially one of the problems that War Games Illustrated has hit, in the fact of whatever people thought of the content in the past prior to Battlefront taking them over. Oh, this is going to sound like I'm knocking Flames of War again, and I'm not, please. But sorry, okay. Yeah, they always say when you're in a hole, stop digging. But you know,
you're shoveling furiously, Neil. Keep shoveling.
I am. But no. I'm taking that as a case in point simply because it is apparent now that and actually, this is something that is discussed. I think myself and Henry talked about a little bit. It's also something I discussed a little. I've done an interview with Jasper Orthoys and Guy Bowers from War Game Soldiers and Strategy, which is coming out in the next month.
Cool.
And part of the whole thing we were talking, I think we cover it very slightly, but you know, this thing about, you know, perceived independence, whether or not you're favouring something or not, part of the issue is perception. And there is no doubt that Battlefront buying War Games Illustrated has changed people's perception of how that publication treats World War II. Okay, so
and also,
as an example,
if I can take that a little bit further, I think it also changes people's perception about how they're going to treat any particular conflict. Because I mean, think what has happened with Flames of War is that they're expanding into Vietnam. There's potential, obviously, for them to expand in a wide variety of different directions. I mean, to stick with World War II, as the company grows, is probably... And you never know. I mean, this is the thing that I find fascinating, just doing things like podcasts independently. You get a wide variety of data sets. They're probably gauging what the next rule set that they could come out with should be based on the feedback that they're getting through the magazine. I mean, the intimacy that they have in these kind of things is phenomenal. But, yeah, I would echo exactly what you're saying. Sorry, I cut you off.
This is nothing new. I mean, for those of us who have the misfortune to be old enough to remember White Dwarf before it became a Games Workshop catalogue.
familiar theme here, Neil.
Here I go making friends and influencing people again. You know,
yeah.
Back in the days when, you know, White Dwarf used to be almost akin to picking up a copy of Dragon, because with the amount of role-playing stuff it used to have in it and all that sort of thing, you know, obviously, again, it's a similar sort of perception change. So yeah, I agree that independence, I would firstly defend my right to be independent simply because, I think not being an independent reviewer, shortchanges people. Now, at the same time, that obviously means that, you know, there are games that I really like that I will say, yeah, I really like this game, and I will promote them. You know, so there are games like Force on Force, things like Excellis, most of the Ganesha games are all sets, which are my current favourite as far as skirmish most skirmish stuff is concerned, and what have you. You know, the rule sets and figure manufacturers I really like. I'm gonna promote them because, I'm a huge fan of Bacchus 6mm figures, I really like Pete Bebby, who runs the company. Is, other than the fact he's a really nice guy, he's also he's really professional, and he produces a good product. So some people would say, well, actually, therefore you're biased because you're promoting one product over another. And yeah, I suppose, yes, you're going to have to agree with them to a certain extent. But, you know, that's going to be the same for everybody. You know, whether your particular love is a particular rule set or a particular particular miniature manufacturer, then, you know, sometimes you cannot help yourself but say, well, you know, I really enjoy this. I'm looking forward to what they're doing next. And, you know, we wouldn't be gamers if we didn't. But generally, you know, simply because somebody calls me and I had that with Incoming. I gave somebody quite a poor review on one of the Incoming video casts, and they took huge exception to what I said, and sent emails to me, to some of my to some people I associated with and what have you, basically turning around and saying, how dare this guy, you know, basically rubbish our particular products and going to other people saying, what are you going to do about it? And going to, you know, people like, you know, show, you know, people who normally sponsor the show, going, yeah, okay, so you know, this guy's rubbishing our product, what are you going to do about it? And getting to that stage, and I was lucky in the case of in that particular instance, Henry and I sing from exactly the same rule book, and we say, okay, you know, we defend our right to be independent in what we think, you know, it's going to be a case of, you know, unfortunately, if we review something, we reserve the right not to like it. Now, most of the time, I will try and give, you know, to be as fair as possible. But, you know, as I've displayed, there are certain rule sets, there are certain games that I do not like, and that's me. So, but it's, yeah, it's important to be independent, because at least it means that whether people agree with me or not, at least they know where I'm coming from. And, you know, I would much rather have a conversation with somebody who vehemently opposes my point of view and, you know, argues the point, but we can have a conversation gamer to gamer, rather than somebody who wants to try and pander to my likes, or, you know, is trying to ply me with views of riches or gaming riches, so I can like their product. But believe me, that doesn't happen.
Well, Neil, in strength of your comments associated with generally being positive, my concern was, it's certainly through this particular podcast, in fact, it's relatively unique, but my perspective as appears on the CWF Gamecast tends to be slightly more negative than I would generally want it. So I really wanted to have the opportunity to talk with you today about the force-on-force rules, just because I knew you would certainly set me straight. And I think you have, well and truly. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you once again. We're going to have to do this with some frequency. I need to confess something here. I didn't actually tell Jonathan that you and I would be talking, and I'm sure he's going to insist that the next time that you're on, that he's at least on the call, but probably it'll be a you and him discussing things show. Maybe a zombie-centric because I've snuck this one in here, and I'm not sure how I'm going to... I'm not sure how I'm going to actually get this one past Jonathan, because I'm sure he'll want to have the opportunity to chat with you. I did have a joke associated with magazine and White Dwarf, but as Jonathan tends to like to keep these things friendly, I'm going to avoid that joke. I'll say that for a little. You guys never get blue on Meagles and Miniature, so I don't know where I can actually put that, but I think I've probably given enough information for folks to fill in the blanks. But anyway, Neil, it's been an absolute pleasure as always to chat with you. I am going to have to pick up the Flying Lead rule set, have a read through it, and maybe have a chat with you about that in the future.
Yes, and certainly. I'm very happy to do that. And thank you very much for having me back on the show. I mean, I did have a couple of comments after the last one, which a couple of my friends listened to it and kind of went, "Are you sure you were awake during some of that podcast?"
Jonathan said to me, Jonathan started editing out the ums and the pauses, and then he just said, "I'm kind of losing some of the flow here. It sounds even more disjointed if I edit out the ums and the pauses." So he just let it slide as was. And I remember re-listening to it just thinking, I don't think, believe me, I think I was, if there was a division of ums and ahs and pauses, it was mine as well. And today's recording is only going to be better in that light. But no, I thought it was a wonderful recording, and I think the opportunity to just chat with you about a variety of different topics that you normally don't cover on Meeples and Miniatures is a real luxury, Neil.
Yeah, well, Tom, I mean, thank you ever so much for inviting me on the show. It is, I mean, amongst other things, it's a real luxury to be on a radio show where you know that at the end of it you haven't then got to spend the next number of hours editing it and, you know, what have you. You can just go back saying, okay, that's now somebody else's job.
I'll let you know a little secret here, Neil. That's the way I feel about this show as well. Anyway, I should probably let you get back to your Saturday evening. It's been an absolute pleasure as always, Neil. We'll need to do it again shortly. Take care.
Tom, I look forward to it, and thank you ever so much for having me on again. Take care.
See ya.
Warning, warning. Coming up next is the Music to Game By segment in the CWF Gamecast. Please stay tuned. We'll be back after this song. We'll be right back.
I say, Major, what on earth are you doing?
It's this blooming issue of Battle Games. It appears to be wearing some kind of futuristic armour. Pass me the can opener so I can try to get it out.
No, no, Major. That is an iPad.
Good Lord, man, don't be daft. It'll never fit under my monocle.
No, Major. The iPad is just another device you can use to read Battle Games magazine, because it's available in digital form as well as on paper.
Digital? What's that? A magazine with fingers? Well, there's still too much newfangled stuff in here. All these tanks and Blitzkrieg Commander and plastic now. They seem to be condoning the replacement of good old-fashioned lead. This is outrageous.
Yes, but there's still plenty of good old-school content as well, like command challenges and even a smattering of Spencer Smith's, what?
Yes, true, and those maps are first-rate. And I've read some excellent book reviews, and articles comparing rule sets and how to make things, and interviews with some jolly interesting chaps. Well, I've got to admit, I've been converted, so get me a pigeon. I need to place an order.
Converted? Excellent, Major. Committed, more like. Come and visit the website at www.battlegames.co.uk, where you can find the magazine on paper for instant digital download or even on CD, so you can simply choose whatever suits you best. You could be downloading and reading your very first issue of Battle Games in just a matter of minutes, so why not give it a try? Battle Games, the spirit of wargaming.
The CWF Gamecast is proudly sponsored by 127games.com. Home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 12-7-games.com. And contest sponsor, Battle Games Magazine, the spirit of wargaming, available at fine hobby shops throughout the United Kingdom and beyond. Subscribe online at www.battlegames.co.uk. This recording is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. Look for the CWF Gamecast online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.